coming, you better run. Well, Abe said, where do you want this killing done? God said, on Highway 61.
Coming back with Bob Dylan, Highway 61, because the great Mike Bloomfield, who played guitar on this track, as well as the Paul Butterfield Band, was born on this day in 1945. So remember him. That was a great song, and he was just he is an incredible guitar player, Paul Butterfield. So let's join our panel here. We are joined here by Dr. Kate Whitehead, once again in the studio, Assistant Professor of Communication, Affiliate Assistant Professor of African and African-American Studies at Loyola University of Maryland, author of the book Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis. And when I was in Georgia this last week picking up my youngest daughter from her honors camp in Valdosta, I went into the national park there just to take a walk through Kennesaw National Park. And in the bookstore was what but Kay's book, Notes from a Colored Girl, sitting there on the shelf. Dr. Rick Vatz is in the studio, Professor of Rhetoric and Communication at Towson University's Department of Instructional Leadership and Professional Development. He wrote the only authentic book of persuasion, and co-authored last Friday a really interesting analysis of this last election in the Baltimore Sun that you all can read, and we'll hit on our website as well. Dr. Anika Simpson joins us. She's Associate Professor in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies here at Morgan State University, and joins us by phone. Anika, welcome. Good to have you back with us as well.
Thanks. Annika, but thank you.
Annika, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Thank you for correcting me.
May I just say that your day in history, okay, once again ratifies what my old professor, Robert Newman, used to say to me when I was a graduate student at the University of Pittsburgh, and that is, people are no damn good.
That's a way to start this morning.
Well, with that, we're going to cover a lot of topics on today, but let's begin with one right now that I think that over the last weekend the last week with some of the murders that have taken place in this country, but at the hands of the police, I think it's some time to really kind of wrestle with these issues. What happened to Mr. Ganera in Long Island? But let's play this tape. You have the tape ready to roll? And we'll get that. It's not ready to roll? Okay. So, well, I guess that's not ready, but let's jump into it anyway. So, folks, join me here at 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Email me at Mark Steiner. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join us for this conversation. We'd love to hear your thoughts. And we're going to cover this. We're going to look at the issues of Ray Rice. We're going to look at what's going on our borders and how that is being affected in the state of Maryland with children coming across the border, even though that's lessened. Look at some of the foreign policy issues if we have time during the course of the hour. Your thoughts on all that, 410-319-8888 is the number here to join us, 410-319-8888. Well, we don't have the tape ready to roll, but we do. Let's play it right now.
Put your hand behind your back. I can't breathe.
Once again, police beating up on people.
Back up.
That was a tape, of course, of Mr. Garner dying in the hands of the police on Long Island, on Staten Island, I should say, in New York City. And you hear him saying, I can't breathe, and you hear his last words as he was being strangled. And I was thinking back to something that happened in our family back in 1971. We were at a family gathering for a birthday last night, and my first wife, Strongheart Stone, and we were talking about one of our closest friends back then, Henry Kellum, who was unarmed and shot and killed by the FBI on a plane in 1971 when they demanded to know why he was on the plane, and then he resisted them and he was killed unarmed. And so there's a cycle. It goes not just here. Someone else in the gathering was saying it's not just America. A young man who was just a peace-loving human being, lived in Negril, Jamaica, was gunned down by the police in Jamaica for no reason at all. It happens across the globe. And there's something about the policing and the state that lends itself to this. So the question is, what do we do about it? How do we begin to respond to it? Annika, why don't you start us off?
Yes, thank you. I think one of the things that I was most disturbed by with the videos is the way that the police ignored his calls for help, and which I think speaks to the devaluation of our black and brown citizens in this country when it comes to the criminal justice system, that he wasn't believed. And I was touched by, at the beginning of the video, the clip, I don't know if you played it, where he was just saying, please just leave me alone, and I'm tired of this, which also just speaks to the relentless, I think, I would almost say attack of black and brown citizens and people who are poor by our law enforcement. So I think we need to have just a grander conversation and go beyond just the investigation of this incident, or because these incidents are not just anomalies. I mean, I think it speaks to more institutional structural racism, and to start to look at reform policies and how the police interact with these communities that of color that want and need law enforcement to come to secure these neighborhoods, but their police are not engaging them in ways that are fruitful or productive, and as we see, that can lead to the loss of life, which is criminal.
Well, let me say a couple things. First of all, you need to have the full context of this. I think I come to the same conclusions as most people being revolted at this, but Mr. Garner was not unaggressive when the police came up to him. He said, the way you've been treating me will stop today. And he was aggressive. But that said, anybody who has seen this, unless there is some bizarre context that is being withheld, is just appalled by it. And the question is, does this in fact show, as some have claimed, a few bad cops, or does it show institutional racism? And Glenn Ford, the editor of Black Agenda Report, famously already has said that it clearly shows institutional racism, but I think it shows a few bad cops. I don't think it shows institutional racism, and I think it will be forever thus. You will have incidents wherein you have hyper-aggressive cops who are not following the rules, and you're going to have these horrible, horrible situations. I don't think it's ever going to stop.
I take issue with the use of the word aggressive. I just get very concerned. I watched a video, as I'm sure a lot of people did, and if you haven't seen it, I would urge you to go onto YouTube and watch it. That's the wonderful thing about YouTube. It democratizes the news. Everybody has access to it. You can see the video for yourself. It's not like the Rodney King incident where you only see a piece of it. You can see the whole thing.
You can't see the whole thing. I disagree with that.
You can see a piece of that, and you can make a decision. But the idea that when you are approached by the cops, you cannot say anything. I did not think he was being aggressive. He said, you are always harassing me. It is going to stop. It's going to stop today. So we can't even respond to the police when they approach us and we're not doing anything. If we respond and say anything, then we are seen as aggressive. And the next thing that happened is an escalation in violence. I mean, I think about the fact that they used a chokehold, which has been outlawed in New York for 20 years.
That's right.
You can clearly see this on the video. You hear the man yelling, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. You see more cops running up to assist the one cop who already has him in a chokehold, who already has him on the ground. You see a cop putting his knee and his hand onto the guy's head and holding him down, and then you see him stop moving.
Where do we disagree?
So I'm disagreeing with the point around this idea of institutionalized racism. You're saying it's not. It's just a few bad cops. I think about that. I think about Syracuse with Alonzo Grant. That just happened. The man called the cops because his daughter was in an incident. The next thing you know, he's being slammed against the railing. He's being arrested for harassing the cops because he called about an incident. I think about New Hampshire where cops were suspended for police brutality. I don't think it's just a few bad cops sprinkled out here. There are too many incidences. I really do believe that it speaks to this idea of institutionalized.
And beyond just isolated incidents, if you just look at New York City, if you look at stop and frisk, if you look at their broken windows policy, I mean, the data shows that these policies are enforced at disproportionate numbers within black and brown communities and communities that are impoverished. And that's just speaking to the data.
You bring
they're
back
not,
Bill
they're
Bratton.
They're not enforced equally across all communities, which I think does speak to some sort of institutional racism. And I don't know if I necessarily agree with that he was acting aggressive. I think that's why I was saying when he was saying, I'm tired of this, I think it's more an indication of how much harassment that, just speaking for myself as an African-American, that black people face with the police. So it wasn't just an isolated incident for him. It's every time he's walking out. And my brothers, my uncles, my father, I mean, it's a continuous story that you hear of people saying that they've had some sort of negative interaction with the police. So you have these incidents that bubble up where you can say, oh, it's just an isolated occurrence. But I don't think that it is. if you peel back the covers and look at the interactions between black and brown people and law enforcement.
I'm not going to be in the position of supporting this incident, so don't imply that I am, because I think I'm not. The question mm-hmm. is whether isolated instance is the same thing as a few bad cops, what a few is defined as. I mean, there are bad cops. Look, when believe it or not, back in the 1970s, when I was protesting against the Vietnam War, I was in Webster Hall Hotel in Pittsburgh, and some cops physically pushed me out of the hotel. And I had done nothing. I mean, I was kind of a protester, but it was kind of meek. And I immediately thought, man, these guys are out of control. And they were out of control. But on the other hand, things have changed, and you'd have to define, before you say institutionalized racism, you'd have to prove that, you'd have to define it. I'm not going to defend in the slightest what they did to Eric Garner. I think it was just outrageous. I'm just saying you've got to let everybody know what the arguments are. But I don't think the argument has been made that throughout police departments in the country we have institutionalized racism.
Well, let me throw a question out here to you all and have folks join us at 410-319-8888 to please weigh in. I'm thinking about the Tyrone West family who was on the show as well just recently coming here often to deal with what happened to Tyrone West. 410-319-8888, your thoughts. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And I think, we can wrestle with this idea of institutional racism, and maybe there's a broader context here as well, that it's the brutality of power.
I think that's a good point to add.
That exists, that you have this power and you do what you want mm-hmm. with that power, and you have this blue wall of silence that surrounds you. Good cops saying we're not going to say anything because you're not supposed to say anything the same way that young people in the inner city go or any place else will go stop snitching, or people who are involved in the other ethnic American crime syndicates who were in the mafia and they always say saying you can't snitch or you die. I mean, those things, yeah. But this blue wall of silence that surrounds the police. But also there's just, is there a way that a society can control through brutality that can be meted out by police for just any reason at all, that just forces that where the violence is overboard? I remember when Anthony Anderson was killed in Baltimore, died in the hands of the police, and I asked the commissioner, I said, when you have a policeman who has him in a bear hug and you have two other cops approaching, was it necessary to pick him up and slam him to the ground? Is that too much force?
Very clear question.
Can you right. just grab him? Can't the other two cops grab his hands, put him in handcuffs, and then take him away? Whether we can argue whether he should have been arrested or not is another question. But is there other? Are we not defining brutality anymore? The kind of measures of force. I mean, that to me is a huge part of the problem. Here it enforces across the globe because they are there to ensure state power, and they do whatever they have to do, what they think they have to do.
And parenthetically, it used to be so much worse. This doesn't mean it's good now, but I'm just saying relatively, police were completely unbothered by hierarchical superiors to attenuate this kind of behavior. That doesn't mean it's good now. I'm just saying that it used to be far worse.
I think we need to put some more checks and balances in place to talk about what you just mentioned, Mark. What can we do to keep the police violence in check? I agree it used to be worse. I do not believe it has gotten any better. I think you have these incidences that bubble up, but I believe, like Annika said, beneath the surface, there are a number of incidences that are going unreported that you're not finding out about. I think it's interesting in New York City with bringing back Bill Bratton. This whole idea of stop and frisk, you know, the broken windows theory, that we have to then go after low-level criminals to stop them from doing more crime. I lived in New York when this happened, and it was everything from the squeegee men to jumping turnstiles. You were arrested, but you also saw these drops in violence, drops in homicide, which may have been related to the fact that unemployment numbers went down. You know, crack cocaine started to wane. So there are a lot of theories that could be a part of it, whether or not it's just the broken windows and stop and frisk. The bigger idea is what can we do to protect our young men in the community, our black and brown young men? So if the police approach you, are we now saying, or have we been saying, you cannot say anything. You cannot speak up. You cannot defend yourself, because any comment from you other than complete acquiescence means that you are being aggressive, means that you are speaking back and could lead to this incident. You can't say, don't touch me. You can't say, don't abuse me. You can't say, leave me alone. You can't say anything.
because any type of response could lead to what happened to Mr. Garner.
Annika, you want to jump in before we open the phones here?
I agree with what Kay has said, and I think going to your broader question, it's just a matter of thinking what type of society that we want to live in. And we incarcerate more human beings here than any other nation on the planet. So I think it does speak to a broader issue about our acceptance of violence and brutality and the criminalization that we have, our attitudes towards criminalization in this country, I find disturbing. But I do think we need to have a conversation about that.
You know, a couple years, let me just say very quickly, a couple years ago I was in traffic court, okay? And I said that I believe that the policeman is misrepresenting what actually happened. And all quiet hell broke loose. I mean, people in power do not like to be questioned. Now, you could repeal that, but I don't know how you do it.
Well, we'll have to figure that out. I'm going to hear what our listeners think at 410-319-8888. And Nathaniel in Baltimore, you're the first caller up. We're going to come to your call soon as we come back from this break. And we're going to break with the 3-Minute Rule by the Beastie Boys from their album Paul's Boutique, released on this day in 1989.
Pigs, cooking, workers, hey, bridges, grab the mic. The city shut down July 6th. The workers are rigged. There's a general strike. Oh! The media claimed that the boys were taking over. I saw it was true.
Now, that's a group called Rancid, not one that I listen to every day, but they're playing a song called Harry Bridges, who was born on this day in 1901. Harry Bridges, born in Australia, was a revolutionary, came to America, and one of the leading organizers of the International Longshoremen Workers Union. So remember him. I'm not sure that Harry Bridges would be listening to Rancid either, but who knows, maybe he would. Here we go. So we're back to our conversation with our guests and some very serious subjects here with Dr. Kay Whitehead from the Loyola University here in Maryland, author of the book Notes from a Colored Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, an amazing book. Dr. Rick Vatz from Towson University, author of the book The Only Authentic Book of Persuasion. Dr. Annika Simpson, professor in Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies here at Morgan State University, and you at 410-319-8888. Right to the phones, and Nathaniel, you're on the air.
Have me. I love your show.
Thank you, Nathaniel.
And Mr. Steiner, I mean, you're a hero, for real. But I'm chomping at the bit here with the gentleman. I don't know if you're black or white, but your incident in 71, when you were pushed, brothers and sisters were being lynched still. If you look at that video, the man wasn't being aggressive. He was pleading for you to stop. Leave me alone. It's exactly like the sister said. You can't say anything to police on the street. If you do, they take that as aggressive. Any word that comes out of a black man's mouth is being aggressive. White men do not understand this because it doesn't happen to them. They get pushed. They don't get punched in the face. Mm-hmm. This is what happens when young black man, or even, oh, I'm 48. I lived in Chicago 15 years. It's the same thing. It's not just sporadic. It's institutionalized. I mean, I believe that if you put police in the communities that they live in, it will, you know, stop that a little bit, because the police that comes, into West Baltimore, he lives in Harford County. Well, maybe not the county, but he doesn't live in West Baltimore. So he doesn't care about how he treats the people or what the people think about him. That's all I have to say.
I have this great fear, as I always have, that when I leave your show, somebody's going to come up to me and say, I hear you are defending the police and how they behaved against Eric Garner. It was appalling. It was appalling without qualification. I'm just saying you need to articulate all of the elements of it, and I'm also saying that when I was a kid and I was part of those who were protesting against the Vietnam War, without doing anything, I was mistreated, and people who did more were sometimes beaten and some and worse. I'm just saying that it used to be worse.
I just want to add, you raised a point earlier, Dr. Vats, about this idea of institutionalized racism, of being able to get all the facts that you need to be able to make an informed decision about what it means to have a system that's based on inequality. I mean, this term that was introduced by Stokely Carmichael in the 1960s. What does it mean to have an unequal system based upon the color of your skin? There is a lot of information out there. So if people are interested in reading more about that, I would suggest they start with some of the early work, starting with the 1960s. What does it mean? Because if you read that, then you can look at what's happening in the police department, and I don't think it's too far flung to say that is a part of institutionalized racism when black and brown men are pulled over and you cannot speak back. This is anecdotal, but I want to add that we were teaching our sons about what to do when the cops pull you over. We taught them not to say anything, to be quiet, because any comment can be seen as being aggressive. I flipped that to when I speak with some of my white friends and they talk to their sons about what to do when the cops immediately tell the cops that you weren't doing anything. Tell them who you are. Tell them, I said to my boys, don't say a word, because any word might be the catalyst to something else happening.
Billy Murphy did a whole piece on this and training people how to respond when the police stop you. And it was a really interesting video I saw Billy do. I had not seen that before. I saw it a few months back. And that is real. Again, I think that we part of it is also what we make illegal in this country. I mean, to have to harass a man because he sells a cigarette,
yes.
to another person. I mean, when I was growing up in my neighborhood, there were always guys selling cigarettes because someone else had the 33 cents to buy a pack of cigarettes and someone else did. So for a quarter, you could sell a cigarette and you could make a little bit of change.
How do you know this so well, Mark? I'm just kind of curious.
I grew up in it. I grew up in it. I sold other things. I didn't sell cigarettes.
Not what I've heard, but go ahead.
But I think that there's also this, that broken windows philosophy that also criminalizes every act.
Every act.
Every act. And I think that there's a danger in what we're creating here. And we really have to – I think we can put a stop to it. We have to put a stop to it. The question of institutionalized racism is something that's much larger that's going to take a long time to kind of weed out in our culture. But make people understand it, because it's a word people – even the word is not really readily understandable.
Right.
Phrase. But let me go to Tom and Carl and Mitchell, are going to come to your calls, or Mitchell, Tom and Carl, whichever way we go to that. But let me just raise another quick issue here separate. Then we'll go right to the phones, guys. You can talk about – and women. You can talk about whatever it is you want to talk about, guys and gals. Talk about whatever you like to talk about. Let me just kind of raise this other issue, because I really think it struck me at a conversation I had last night, and conversations taking place around people's kitchen tables and barbershops and coffee shops around the city and the country, is Ray Rice. And Ray Rice being told not to play for two games, somebody has found to smoke marijuana that penalized four games. A player who was found to get a free tattoo in college was suspended for five games. And people who are involved in these activities of misogyny and affecting women, it's always treated very lightly in our world of sports and in our world, period. So,
yes.
I mean, I'm showing my bias here, I know, I'm sorry, but yeah. I mean, your thoughts. Annika, you want to start?
I think our sentiments are shared. My question is just, what does this say about our values as a country? I think clearly the punishment that was meted out does not equal what the incident that happened, or to show the NFL's intolerance of domestic violence policies, domestic violence incidences. My concern is what's going to happen mid-season. So if Rice has a good season and he's performing well, will this issue completely disappear? Is it going to stay at the forefront of our consciousness as it is now if he is bringing in dollars and W's, checks in the win column for the Ravens?
I tend to, with this idea that Annika and Mark are talking about, I wanted to look at it from a different perspective, because what concerns me is what Ray's now wife, how she has responded. The fact that this incident happened and she married him the next day, and now she's standing by and with him, rather than walking away from this man who seems to have a problem with anger. Any man that hits a woman, knocks her unconscious, and then drags her by her hair out of the elevator clearly has some problems with boundaries and some problems with anger and some problems with understanding what it means and how it means to treat people with respect. And she still married him. I think that there's a greater concern here. Yes, we look at Ray Rice and the fact that what he received does not fit what he actually did, this punishment that was meted out. At the same time, he seems to be winning all the way around because she married him. I'm also very concerned when I think about Stephen A. Smith's comments from ESPN. I mean, that was blowing up Twitter this weekend. If you follow this idea that even though he said on one hand, I know what to do if somebody hits, you know, my wife or my sister or my mother and all of my boys and all of my friends, we all know how to respond. Then he turned back around and said, well, let's talk about whether or not women actually provoke men to make these type of stances. What does it mean to hold a woman responsible? That's along the same line as I raped her because her skirt was too short or she was asking me to hit her. I think there's some bigger issues beyond Ray Rice that we need to get at around violence against women, not just in this country. But we can go to the entire planet talking about genital mutilation with young girls. Rape is a form of terror. Like, well, there's a lot we can discuss
marrying
here.
Off girls when they're 11, 12,
Mark,
13
yes.
years old.
Yeah, you didn't put it together for unanimity today, did you?
We put you together for a good conversation.
Okay. Let me give some reaction to this, which will be unpopular. First of all, where I agree with you is that I think the comments by Smith were despicable, and I have nothing to say beyond what you've said about that. With respect to the Ray Rice punishment by the Ravens, the punishment should be consistent with the criminal justice system finding on him. The punishment should be consistent with the relationship to his job. When people have jobs and they do terrible things, what should their employers do? Well, it depends on how what they did relates to what they do in their job. People shouldn't necessarily lose their job because they did something terrible. So I think that the Ravens have much less responsibility here than the criminal justice system. I think you can make a much stronger argument, an argument that I would agree with, that the criminal justice system went weak on Ray Rice. To argue, therefore, the Ravens should compensate for that by giving him a 4 or 6 game suspension, I think is a non sequitur. I don't think that the Ravens have done anything wrong here. As a matter of fact, I think the National Football League has done what is probably correct. That is, they gave him a punishment consistent with the reactions of the criminal justice system, and it's consistent with his relationship, with the relationship of what he did to his job. When people use drugs, that is directly related to their work as football players. This is not.
I think I do agree that in certain it depends on the workplace or the environment. But if you go to the NFL's personal conduct policy, they have a policy in place that speaks to this issue. So we cannot have football players going out and acting in criminal ways or engaging in domestic violence. And you have